Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. Hi, I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Trump administration's national security advisor threatening a military option against North Korea, in addition to Japan's defense minister sounding the alarm at a meeting in the Philippines with the U.S. and South Korean defense ministers that the nuclear and missile threat from North Korea had reached an unprecedented, critical, and imminent level, requiring different responses. A former U.S. ambassador to South Korea, Donald Gregg, who was Vice President George H.W. Bush's national security advisor, joins us to discuss his concern that Donald Trump is the greatest threat to peace and stability in Asia. He urges the Trump White House to urgently take up the offer by former President Carter to act as an envoy to resume diplomatic dialogue with North Korea before the war of words and reckless threats lead to a war that could see the first nuclear weapons used since Nagasaki, in spite of General McMaster's assertion that there are military options available to deal with North Korea. Then we'll assess the impact of Senator Jeff Flake's impassioned resignation speech before the United States Senate today, in which he lamented the damage being done to the country by Donald Trump and pleaded with his Senate colleagues to show the leadership and courage necessary to oppose the destruction and desecration of American values, appealing to them in the name of our children, who will ask, quote, "Why didn't you do something? Why didn't you speak up?" Joining us to discuss the likelihood that both U.S. Senate seats in Arizona will be contested in the next election is Evan Wyloge, an investigative reporter with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, who previously spent 5 years as a reporter for the Arizona Capital Times. We will discuss the number of Republicans vying for the seats and how much this could be an opportunity for the Democrats and who they might run. Then finally, we will speak about Trump's expected announcement on what he will do about the opioid crisis with Dr. Andrew Kolodny, the co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University, who is also the executive director of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. He joins us to discuss the article in The New Yorker profiling the Sackler family, who own Purdue Pharma, and how these prominent philanthropists pushed their drug OxyContin to generate billions in profits while creating millions of addicts in what has become America's opioid epidemic. And joining us now is Donald Gregg, a career CIA officer who served as Vice President George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor and United States Ambassador to South Korea. In 2007, the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies established a foreign policy fellowship in the ambassador's name, and his latest book is Potsherds, Fragments of a Life Lived in CIA, the White House, and the Two Koreas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Donald Gregg.
Delighted to be here.
Well, thank you. And there's been some rather dire warnings coming from the Japanese defense minister at a conference in the Philippines, along with our Secretary of Defense and South Korea's defense minister. I saw the other night on MSNBC General Barry McCaffrey say that we'll be at war with North Korea by the summer. And then the National Security Advisor, General H.R. McMaster, said that threatening a military option in North Korea keeps Kim Jong-un in check, and he defended our president has been really clear. He's not going to permit this regime and Kim Jong-un to threaten the United States with nuclear weapons. He's going to do anything necessary to prevent that from happening. And what Kim Jong-un should recognize is that he thinks the developments of his nuclear capabilities keeping him safer. It's actually the opposite. And then he went on to say that there is no military option. I imagine that's a reference to what Stephen Bannon said. He said that talk is wrong. There are military options. So as somebody that knows the Koreas well and are in contact with North Korean officials in New York, are you alarmed?
Actually, not as much as people might think, because, one, the North Koreans are not suicidal. They know that if they do something heavy to us, they will just be eradicated. We also need to free ourselves from some of the rhetoric of the past that talking is rewarding bad behavior. It is not. Talking is the way to determine clearly what the North Koreans want. And most of our foreign policy people say, well, we don't know what they want. Well, that's because we haven't asked them, and we haven't listened to their response. What they want, I believe, is to be treated with respect. They want to be certain that we do not intend to blow them out of the water, and they want to have some ground upon which they can improve their economy. So I think the way lies open for sending a high-level track two group to North Korea to sit down and talk with them and say, how can we start a dialogue? And I think they would be very interested in that if it were led by somebody they knew and respected. I'm more worried by Trump than I am by Kim Jong-un. And so I think that we need to be aware that the North Koreans want a dialogue with us. They always have. And we just have to be adult enough and mature enough and confident enough to work through to the beginning of a dialogue. And if we do, I think the situation there can be ameliorated fairly quickly.
So would you then suggest that former President Jimmy Carter, who's made himself available, he's apparently had contact with General McMaster in the Trump White House and offered up his services, having already gone to North Korea, dealing with Kim Il-sung and then Kim Jong-il after that. So would that be a useful option?
Well, certainly would. I mean, he's always available. I mean, I would love to see President Obama offer to go because he's a more recent figure. But Jimmy Carter is certainly somebody who the North Koreans know and would take very seriously. So I hope that something like that can take place, because I think there is room for serious dialogue, and we just need to be willing to run those risks. I think that in Kim Jong-un we are dealing with a risk-taking but very courageous young man, and I think he does not want to commit suicide. And I think he strikes a hard bargain, but I think he wants, as most North Koreans have wanted, a very serious, high-level dialogue with the United States. And why we aren't willing to undertake steps to bring that about, I'm not clear.
And Ambassador Gregg, why do you say he's courageous? What is your point there?
Well, I think that he could avoid. I mean, he could sort of be more compliant with us. I mean, he could sort of play footsie with us and sort of kick the can down the road if he wanted to. But he's taking a tougher line, and I think he's right to do so, because I think it's by taking a tougher line that he will get us to take him seriously and really raise the stakes and raise the level of our commitment so that we can get something done.
Well, I think he's got our attention with nuclear tests, with a thermonuclear test, apparently, and with advancements in missile technology that many suggest could result in his ability to strike the U.S. homeland, perhaps even in a matter of months.
Okay, well, then why? Where is the Trump administration? Why don't they respond to that? I mean, I think I am not at all happy with the man who is president of our country. I think there are some people emerging, General Kelly among them, who are trying to hedge him in and push him in the right direction. But the table is set. I think it's our move, and I think we need to make a significant move, but I'm not at all certain that the Trump administration is willing to do it. For example, we don't even have an ambassador in South Korea today. I mean, it's crazy the things we have not done. So we need to get serious. We need to begin to get involved, to commit ourselves, to get high-level people involved and begin to talk to the North Koreans.
And, of course, our Secretary of State has been undercut by our president. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has referred to it as a form of castration. And he did. Trump did tweet out a while back that Rex Tillerson is wasting his time negotiating with the Chinese. What's your sense about China's role? Because China and North Korea are not the best of friends, are they?
They hate each other. Yeah. They hate each other. I mean, we've been trying for years to get China to do our work for us, and they won't. And I think they're wise not to. I mean, in any really lasting, stable settlement is going to involve us from the get-go. The Chinese can act as a lubricant, they can act as a commentator, but we cannot ask them to do what we ourselves have to do if we're really serious on solving this problem with the North Koreans.
Did you read the piece by Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times, who made a recent trip to North Korea?
Yes.
What did you make of that? Because he was suggesting that the foreign ministry people were worried about his safety because the level of patriotism and jingoism has been ramped up by Kim Jong-un, who made a rare appearance on North Korean TV, and that the place is mobilized, and that the hawks in North Korea not only think they could survive a nuclear war, but they could win a nuclear war. So how do you tamp that down?
Well, I think that's crazy on their part, and they shouldn't be allowed to get away with that kind of thinking without it being challenged. And I think the only answer to that is for us to get various serious people with real reputations established who begin to speak to those issues and saying that's nonsense. And to talk of military options is nonsense and is something that involves immeasurable human cost. And the way to avoid that is to start building toward a dialogue with where the stakes can really be dealt with. And we've got to be willing to do that. We've got to be willing to put the people involved in it who carry enough weight to gain the respect of the North Koreans and can get the ball rolling on this issue.
And since you were ambassador to South Korea, Donald Gregg, what's your understanding of how the South Koreans feel about this bellicose rhetoric coming from the Trump White House? Because they're collateral damage, as we are told many times, that the North Koreans have a lot of artillery tubes and rockets aimed at Seoul, and that in any conflict, Seoul would talk about Trump talking about raining down fire and fury. There would be fire and fury rained down on Seoul. And I assume that if there were any evacuations or measures like that, that might ramp up the alarm in the north and be some kind of tripwire. So it seems to me that we're being pretty cavalier about the lives of South Koreans here.
Well, certainly, yes. Certain of our statements have been, particularly by Trump. I think the president of South Korea is a sensible man. He is very much interested in establishing some kind of dialogue, and I think he's made very uncomfortable by some of these statements coming from Trump. That's why I say, to me, Trump is the most unstable, most disturbing figure involved in what we're talking about. And I think he needs to be contained, and he needs to be surrounded and encouraged to say only those things which can pave the way forward, not things that just increase the sense of disorder and fear. There's just too much fear and too much aversion to taking any kind of calculated risk or dialogue floating around here. And I think a lot of it is because of the loose dialogue, particularly from Trump himself.
So you're suggesting that Trump has sort of boxed himself in this kind of macho bravado, and that he can't sort of take that conciliatory step?
Well, he can, but I think that's very much unlike him. I mean, I think that it's, there are people who are saying, can he be made to stop tweeting? Can he be made to think before he speaks? And the answer is doubtful. And so I think that's the reason that he is much more disturbing to me than Kim Jong-un.
Well, apparently, and these reports have not been totally confirmed, but there's been a number of them, that our B-52 fleet, the nuclear triad's bomber, the side of the nuclear triad, and I imagine that would also involve B-1 and B-2 bombers, either have been put on an alert or about to be put on alert, which means that they sit at the end of the runways full of fuel and armed and ready with their crews ready to go at a moment's notice. If that is true, it may well be amping up the pressure on North Korea, as McMaster mentioned, that there are military options, and without saying what they are. But my sense is, if this is true, that the our bombers are on high alert, fueled up, loaded up with bombs, ready to go, wouldn't that alarm the Russians as well, and perhaps even the Chinese?
Would alarm everybody. You know, I have no idea whether this is true or not. I mean, I hope it is not. But, you know, I'm in no position to verify that. But I think that kind of thing is very disturbing. We need to take it seriously and say, how do we de-escalate this? And the way, I think, to de-escalate it is the beginning of a dialogue with the North Koreans, where we say to them, what is it you want? And then we listen to what they say, and we take them seriously, and we push aside those who say, oh, talking to those people is rewarding bad behavior. Well, you know, jaw, jaw, jaw is much better than war, 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 as I guess it was Roosevelt who said.
Winston Churchill, I think it was.
Was it Churchill? Well, that makes it even better.
Well, I like FDR. But in any case, just to touch on, you mentioned earlier, Ambassador Gregg, how much the Chinese and the North Koreans hate each other, and that we keep expecting the Chinese to get our irons out of the fire, and that's just never going to happen. Given that Kim Jong-un killed his uncle, who was apparently the liaison to Beijing, and his older half-brother, who was under the protection of the Chinese, is there any possibility of the Chinese wanting to conduct some kind of coup? Because it seems as though Kim Jong-un is kind of proactive in that regard. He might well be worried about the Chinese. Do the Chinese have intelligence and military assets in North Korea?
I'm sure they do. I know nothing about that, but I don't think they would be in the business of thinking about a coup. I think that's not the way they work, and I certainly would not suggest that line of thinking be supported. I mean, I think we are the central figure that has to get involved, and we have to show that we are serious. We have to show that we are patient. We have to show that we are tough-minded. And that we will listen to solid or sensible things that the North Koreans have to say to us. And that's the way it's got to go. And I think, you know, there's been all kinds of efforts to sort of dodge that. But sooner or later, it's got to be us, and there's no time like the present to get started.
Well, just in closing, though, the assumption is that China is genuinely worried about North Korea, and particularly about its gaining nuclear weapons and now thermonuclear weapons and being provocative, because from the Chinese point of view, as far as I understand, they're worried that this might force the Japanese into spending more on the military, which is already happening. It may even force the Japanese to go nuclear. It may do the same with the South Koreans. And at the very least, it's bringing more U.S. military attention and assets into the neighborhood, which is surely not what the Chinese want.
Absolutely. I agree with that. And it's not what we want. I mean, a nuclear, you know, a proliferation is something we need to work hard against. And the way to stop it is to not let things unravel any farther than they are at this point. And that's why we need to get involved and really raise the stakes and raise the caliber of our involvement and start a dialogue with the North Koreans. And that's, I think, the best thing we can do. It may be difficult for us to do it because we've been rather feckless up to now, but I think it's something we can do and we must do.
So at the end of the day, that's what it comes down to, right? That we have no choice but to negotiate and stop this reckless brinkmanship.
Absolutely.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Donald Gregg, a career CIA officer who served as Vice President George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor and the United States Ambassador to South Korea. In 2007, the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies established a foreign policy fellowship in the ambassador's name, and his latest book is Potsherds, Fragments of a Life Lived in CIA, the White House, and the Two Koreas. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back assessing the impact of Senator Jeff Flake's impassioned resignation speech today before the U.S. Senate.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. War is not the answer. Politician and them bubonaiers thing, yeah. War is not the answer. Something over the solution, Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer. Tell the politician and them start drop them bomb, yeah. War is not the answer. Something over the solution, Rasta says, yeah. War is not the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Evan Wyloge, who's an investor reporter with the Arizona Center for Investor Reporting, who covers politics and government in Arizona with a focus on watchdog data and accountability journalism. He previously spent 5 years as a reporter at the Arizona Capital Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, Evan Wyloge.
Thank you.
And given the extraordinary speech that was made today on the floor of the Senate by Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona, the junior senator who's resigning, it was very much a kind of Mr. Smith goes to Washington, Jimmy Stewart moment, very impassioned. And the other senator, of course, John McCain, has terminal brain cancer. It does seem, at least to me, Evan, that is a pretty sad statement on our politics, that the only people who are prepared to stand up and speak truth to power in our politics are a man with brain cancer and two senators who are quitting.
Yeah, well, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if this is something that continues and we end up having more of the elected officials in Washington speaking their mind in this way.
You think that's, that seems to have been, in many ways, Jeff Flake's intention, right? To give his colleagues some backbone.
It sure sounded like it. I mean, we'll have to see, but it looks like, you know, every month that goes by, there seems to be a little bit more vocal discontent.
Well, it was pretty powerful when Flake said, "We must stop pretending that the conduct of some in our executive branch is normal. They are not normal. Reckless, outrageous, and undignified behavior has become excused and countenanced as telling it like it is, when it is actually just reckless, outrageous, and undignified. And when such behavior emanates from the top of our government, it is something else. It is dangerous to a democracy. It is often said that children are watching. Well, they are. And what are we going to do about that? When the next generation asks us, why didn't you do something? Why didn't you speak up? What are you going to say?" I mean, boy, that's pretty strong.
Pretty stirring.
Yeah. So let's talk about what's likely to happen in your state. It's shaping up that Arizona could be the state that will decide who controls the next U.S. Senate, right?
It sure could. You know, Arizona and a few other states are probably going to be a big focus next year. You know, the last time you and I spoke was when we heard the prognosis for Senator John McCain and that it was not a great prognosis. And so we have both of these seats. Who's going to say who's going to be filling these seats in a year or 2 years?
Well, we know about the candidate that's up now in terms of what I think Mitch McConnell was behind the campaign that called Kelly Ward Chemtrail Kelly. She's backed by Stephen Bannon, and she's actually, of course, pretty thrilled with what just happened today. She tweeted out that the Arizona voters are the big winners in Jeff Flake's decision to not seek re-election. They deserve a strong conservative in the Senate. What are her chances?
Well, I think we'll have to come back and take a second look at that tweet in a few months. The growing consensus, at least among political observers here, is that we will have more Republicans jump into this race, and probably some pretty well-heeled Republicans. Representative Martha McSally from the Tucson area is known for massive fundraising, and I already see people throwing her name around on Twitter talking about whether she'll run. We've also got other members in the House who it would make sense if they were interested. You've got Paul Gosar, who represents the western part of the state, rural Arizona. You've got even Representative Trent Franks, who represents a very conservative part of the Maricopa County Metro Phoenix area on the outskirts of town. There's, you know, even people talking about Representative David Schweikert, who represents a slightly more moderate, more central Phoenix congressional district. So I think we'll end up seeing some more competition. I doubt that this is going to be the end of the action on the Republican side of this primary.
Well, given that there are likely to be two seats up, if the governor has to replace Senator McCain's seat, is there anybody that the governor would be likely to put in to give them a leg up?
Gosh, I mean, who's to say? He's certainly deft and careful. So I think there would be a lot of thought put into that decision. I think it's probably too early to say. And if they have somebody on their minds, him and his allies, they certainly haven't dipped their hat.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Evan Wylosh, an investigative reporter with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, who covers politics and government in Arizona with a focus on watchdog data and accountability journalism. He previously spent 5 years as a reporter at the Arizona Capital Times. But the assumption would be, though, Evan, is that the Democratic establishment, to use Stephen Bannon's pejorative, and which is why he's running Kelly Ward, and I believe the Mercer's billionaire family that were the largest donors to Donald Trump, are going to bankroll her, and she's kind of in the mold of Judge Roy Moore down in Alabama. So the question would be, you know, you've mentioned some of those names of likely candidates. Who are the ones that would most fit into the mold of the maverick John McCain and the maverick Jeff Flake?
Gosh, that's a tough question. I don't think any of them really have a stake to claim that they are a maverick within the party. You know, you've definitely got, you're right. I think Kelly Ward is most analogous to a Roy Moore type, but, you know, just as conservative as Representative Trent Franks and Paul Gosar. So they both also, you know, present themselves as very conservative and could potentially run on the same, in that same lane of the Republican Party. I don't think that there's anybody who is quite like Senators McCain or Flake in especially given what we've seen out of them in the past year.
So then does that give the Democrats an opening?
It sure does. I think, you know, probably a mixed bag with today's news for Kyrsten Sinema. I think she was banking on running against Senator Flake. I think it'll take some recalculation if they're going to look at the possibility of running against Kelly Ward or even another incumbent from the Republican delegation. But, you know, she's also a very strong fundraiser. She's been known for that for several cycles now. And I think she's going to put up about as good a fight as any Democrat can in Arizona. She certainly has tried to move a little bit more toward the center and become, you know, a moderate Democrat in the House. And she's worked hand-in-hand with Republicans on bipartisan bills, and she likes to talk about that and really highlight her moderate credentials.
But she's pretty unique, if not unusual, isn't she? She's a Kyrsten Sinema. In 2012, she became the first openly bisexual person elected to Congress, and then later she broke ground by becoming the first member of Congress to state as her religion none, and identifies herself as religiously unaffiliated. And that's, you know, that takes some courage, doesn't it?
It sure does. And you're right. She is an unusual candidate. She has been for if you paid attention over the past several years to her specifically, you've seen a real shift, because when, you know, she first ran for the Arizona legislature under the Green Party, and then after that didn't work, she ran as a Democrat and she got into the legislature, and she was known for being pretty far to the left, although she did have some bipartisan bills that she had worked on. And then as she ran for Congress and was elected into the House, has attempted to moderate. But you are right that she, you know, her sexuality, her religious preference, definitely not quite in the mold of anybody.
Well, presumably there'll be the Democrats nationally are going to be paying attention to this, the state of Arizona, because it is the first sign of a possible pickup. I think they're also somewhat encouraged by Tennessee. Marsha Blackburn has taken a bit of a hit from her support of a bill that hobbled the DEA, preventing them from dealing with the opioid crisis. And I think she's in a bit of trouble for that. I'm talking about caucus open seat in Tennessee. But you've got, assuming you have two open seats in Arizona, if Kyrsten Sinema goes for one of them, who else could go for the other on the Democratic side?
Gosh, I mean, your guess is as good as mine on that one. That's a good question. I'm really not sure.
Well, isn't there a young Democrat who's fairly telegenic? I think he might be he's got a Hispanic surname, and he might, I think he might be a veteran, too. I'm trying to think.
Oh, I think you're talking about Ruben Gallego.
Ruben Gallego, there you go. That's who I'm thinking of, yeah.
Sure. You know, I think he's fairly young. I think he's definitely got ambition to move beyond the House of Representatives, but I would doubt that he would jump at this opportunity because Kyrsten Sinema has been such a fundraising giant in Arizona relative to him.
Right, but there are two, assuming there are two open seats, the Democrats are going to have to come up with two candidates, and if Representative Kyrsten Sinema is the most likely, and you think she's most likely to run for Jeff Flake's seat.
Oh, sure. So
who would run for McCain's seat? That's my question.
Sure, now I get you. Well, I don't think we have a very deep bench on the Democratic side. You know, there would probably be some, I mean, let's see, you know, we had former Representative Ann Kirkpatrick. You know, she is still, I believe, looking at running this next cycle against Martha McSally. So there'd be a possibility that she would step up and run again for the Senate, which is when the last time she lost, when she ran against McCain.
But in general, the mood, though, in the state, I mean, the polls were basically pretty dismal for Jeff Flake, and I was kind of surprised that he didn't have more support, because he seems to be an honorable, decent guy who takes very principled and moral stands. What happened to his support?
You know, I think that a lot of the people here in Arizona who watch politics were pretty confused by the poll numbers that came out that were so bad. And I know I, among others, looked at those and thought that maybe they were a fluke of a poll. But obviously that's not the case. And it appears that Arizona, like a lot of other parts of the country, has further polarized, and the Republican base has moved away from the center, and you know, support for guys like Jeff Flake and John McCain have eroded. You know, we saw John McCain during his primary against Kelly Ward last time around. You know, she got, I think, more of the Republican primary vote than people expected her to.
Well, does that mean then that, what would your guess be then for the general, assuming that the Democrats, you know, they have one candidate who's got a pretty unusual biography running, maybe against in the open seat of Flake's that he just resigned from, that up against Kelly Ward, and then on the other side, in terms of John McCain's seat, we don't even know yet. And you mentioned a bunch of possibilities on the Republican side. What I'm hearing from you, Evan, is that the Republicans have a deeper bench and are probably more likely to hold these two seats.
I would say so. I think that's the safe bet. The Republicans definitely have a deeper bench, and they would definitely be able to put up several candidates for either of these seats that represent a range on the Republican spectrum from far conservative to more moderate. And Arizona, as we've seen over and over, has been pretty reliably Republican, and probably expect, you know, like I said, the safe money is expect that to continue.
But it's one thing to be reliably Republican, but there's a war going on within the Republican Party, which is what Jeff Flake made really clear today in before the U.S. Senate. And I'm just wondering what would happen if John McCain were to basically, obviously, he's the prognosis is not good. And at some point or other, could he name a successor that would carry on his legacy as opposed to the sort of Tea Party, Stephen Bannon, deconstruct the administrative state, the kind of rebellion to tear things down as opposed to build on a legacy?
Yeah, I think as long as Doug Ducey is the governor, there's a chance that if there's an appointment, you know, in that chance, I think the governor would pick somebody more moderate. I don't see him picking somebody who's a real fire-breathing Bannon-type Republican. So in the case that Senator McCain needed to have someone fill his seat for whatever reason that comes down the line, I think it would be a safe bet that Doug Ducey would pick somebody more moderate than not.
And just in closing then, what's your sense about, I mean, maybe we should talk in a day or two to get some feedback on what happened today. I frankly found Jeff Flake's speech to be really powerful and even inspiring. And it's sort of sad, as I say, I've said it a couple of times, you know, it's sort of a sad comment that you either have to be terminally ill or quitting the U.S. Senate to, in order to step up and be honest. And you know, he clearly was trying to force his colleagues into doing the right thing and making a stand. But how do you think it's going to be, apart from what Kelly Ward said, you know, which is obviously dismissive and we know where she's coming from, what do you expect will be the way the state of Arizona reacts to their junior senator basically quitting his job in disgust?
Well, so far we've seen the Arizona Republican Party send out a big thank you. I think that's going to be the sentiment you're going to hear from a lot of more mainstream Republicans, is that they, you know, appreciated him for his service. You'll probably see a little bit that slight minority that cheer on what this brings in, you know, more competition and the chance that this does go to a more Bannon-style Republican. So I think this is going to be developing soon and over the next few days and weeks, like you mentioned. And if I were a Republican political consultant, I would be calling up all these House members and talking to them about what they want to do, because I think that we're going to hear some announcements real soon.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Evan Wyloge.
Sure thing. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Evan Wyloge, who's an investor reporter with the Arizona Center for Investor Reporting, who covers politics and government in Arizona with a focus on watchdog data and accountability journalism. He previously spent 5 years as a reporter at the Arizona Capital Times. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking about the Sackler family who owned Purdue Pharma and how these prominent philanthropists pushed their drug OxyContin to generate billions in profits while creating millions of addicts in what has become America's opioid epidemic.
Gone, gone. damage done.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Andrew Kolodny, who's the co-director of the Opioid Policy Research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. His primary area of focus is the prescription drug, opioid, and heroin crisis devastating families and communities across the country. He's also the executive director of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing, an organization with a mission to reduce morbidity and mortality caused by overprescribing of opioid analgesics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Andrew Kolodny.
Thanks for having me.
And there was a recent article in the New Yorker that was quite disturbing about Purdue Pharma and the family that owned, the Sackler family that owned Purdue, a privately held company. I've learned recently that Purdue spent about $6 billion promoting OxyContin, the drug that's really at the heart of the opioid epidemic. And apparently in reformulating that drug, they've actually had the unintended consequences of creating a heroin epidemic in this country. So this seems like a pretty dreadful kind of legacy for this family, the Sacklers, who are big patrons of the arts and philanthropists.
That's right. The actions of Purdue Pharma have led to a severe epidemic of opioid addiction in the United States. We have millions of Americans who are now addicted to opioids, and we have thousands who have lost their lives to overdoses. And the reason we have this severe epidemic is that the medical community started prescribing opioids very aggressively. Beginning in 1996, with the release of OxyContin, Purdue Pharma very aggressively promoted its new pain reliever. But what was even worse is that Purdue promoted opioids as a class of drug as being non-addictive and funded a multifaceted campaign so that doctors started hearing from every direction that the risk of addiction had been overblown and that we were under-prescribing and that patients were suffering needlessly because we were too fearful in using these medicines. And as we responded to this campaign and as the prescribing increased, it led to an epidemic of addiction and death.
Well, they even didn't Purdue in 1999 fund a study to suggest that OxyContin could be used for headaches?
Yes. So Purdue Pharma would not have had financial success. Purdue Pharma would not have had financial success with OxyContin had the drug only been prescribed to patients at the end of life with cancer. Purdue would not have had financial success with OxyContin if it had only been prescribed to patients at the end of life with cancer. End of life cancer pain is not a common condition, and patients won't be on your drug for very long if they're at the end of life. The way you can do well with a pharmaceutical product, the way you can have a blockbuster drug, is if you convince the medical community to prescribe it for common problems like headache or low back pain, conditions where opioids are not safe or even effective when taken long-term. That's where the market is, and that's where opioids as a class of drug were promoted most aggressively.
So where would you hold Purdue Pharma in terms of accountability for the opioid crisis and how it's morphed in? Because I understand the reformulation of OxyContin to prevent it from being injected and snorted has actually led to an epidemic of heroin abuse.
Sort of. What we have in the United States is a severe epidemic of opioid addiction. And we have two groups of Americans who are opioid addicted, an older group that's been dying of overdoses on pain medicine, and a younger group that's mostly been dying of overdoses from heroin. The younger group switches to heroin after they become addicted because young, healthy-looking 25-year-olds have a hard time getting doctors to give them a large quantity on a monthly basis. So the young people wind up on the black market pretty soon after becoming addicted. That young group has been switching to heroin once they wind up on the black market because it's much less expensive. And that switching to heroin really began at around 20 years ago, and it just increased steadily. It is true, though, that when Purdue Pharma made OxyContin harder to crush for snorting or injecting, many people who had been snorting or injecting it did switch over to heroin, which is easier to snort and inject. But the problem with heroin really begins at the outset of our opioid addiction epidemic that begins with a campaign to increase prescribing.
Well, there was a book in 2015 by Sam Quiñones, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, and where he says that heroin dealers from Mexico fanned out across the United States to supply a burgeoning market of people who had been primed by pill addiction, mostly from OxyContin, and that the reformulation of OxyContin had actually opened the door for heroin.
That's accurate. So as doctors began to prescribe opioids more aggressively, and as addiction to opioids began to increase, it created a market for heroin. And older people who were becoming addicted didn't have trouble finding doctors who would continue them on large quantities of pills, but the younger folks who were addicted would wind up on the black market in order to maintain their opioid supply. And if that young person was in a region of the country where heroin was available, they'd switch to it because it was much cheaper. And what began happening is that heroin started moving into more regions of the country where it wasn't previously available to meet the demand for it by this growing number of young people who had become addicted to prescription opioids that they were using either medically or recreationally.
So, Dr. Andrew Kolodny, back to the family held company, Purdue Pharma, and the Sacklers. They were a family that came out of, they were physicians, were they not, originally? The Brooklyn-born brothers, Arthur Mortimer and Raymond Sackler. Now, the Purdue Pharma is now controlled by the next generation, but they've all been very big in philanthropy. Do you know how they're dealing with this, particularly with the piece in The New Yorker, which is pretty devastating? Has anybody heard from them? Because I think they're among the richest families in the United States. I think they're worth about $13 billion.
Yes, I don't know how the family is reacting to The New Yorker article, but I am wondering how the many institutions and organizations that have been taking the Sackler money, how they're reacting. I would hope that they think of that money as blood money, that they would recognize that thousands of people lost their lives for that money and millions of people have become addicted. And I'd like to see the Sackler name coming off of some of these buildings and wings and museums.
And is there any, apart from the article in The New Yorker, is there any public movements afoot to name and shame them?
Not that I'm aware of. I'm hopeful that the more journalists like yourself cover this subject, that it may lead to organizations rethinking their relationship with the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma.
So the recent sort of mini scandal, if you will, over Trump's nominee to be the drug czar, the congressman who ended up, we found out that he and Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee had basically gotten a law slipped through that essentially hobbled the DEA from intercepting large quantities of these illicit opioids that we're talking about. And it was really, as much as Donald Trump has been pretty consistent in cabinet appointees essentially putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank, this seemed to be a case that was just too flagrant, with Congressman Marino, who promptly withdrew his nomination to be the drug czar. I would have thought that might have helped this cause a little. What's your sense?
Well, I'm pleased to see that Tom Marino is no longer the nominee to lead the Office of National Drug Control Policy. His only real experience on the topic was pushing through a bill that dramatically weakened the DEA's ability to go after legal narcotics manufacturers and distributors and pill mills. So what we need is the helm of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, the White House drug czar, is someone who's got experience, who understands this issue, and who's capable of coordinating a federal response to the problem. There are many different federal agencies that have a piece of this issue, like the CDC and the DEA and FDA and CMS, and we need all of these agencies working together, and that's something the drug czar can be doing. I believe that Trump was nominating because Marino was an early supporter, and for a position like ONDCP director, that's not a place to pay back a friend for political. It needs the most qualified person we can find to steward or respond to the most urgent public health problem facing the country.
Well, given that Purdue spent $6 billion advertising the drug, and it's pretty clear that they downplayed its addictive qualities, and as you pointed out earlier, they tried to make it more available for a whole range of ailments because there wasn't enough money in end-of-life palliatives because people die. That's the whole point. So do we have a breakdown of how much that $6 billion in advertising created in terms of profits?
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with that $6 billion figure. I know that they were spending $30 million a year by year five after the introduction of OxyContin. And while much of that money was spent specifically promoting their new pain medicine, at the time at least it was new, we know they were spending quite a bit for a multifaceted, non-branded campaign to get the medical community to feel comfortable with opioids as a class of drug. And that's what had the most devastating impact, because all opioid prescribing started to go up, not just OxyContin.
Well, I think what I find extraordinary is having sort of, you know, tried to understand the war on drugs, and particularly when it emerged recently with this congressman being nominated for the drug czar, to find out that he had hobbled the Drug Enforcement Agency and the Drug Enforcement Administration. We know that, of course, was a 60 Minutes expose, and a lot of people were alarmed by it, and I believe Trump himself saw that as well. It was pretty amazing to have DEA, senior DEA people, to basically say that, you know, we got done in by a congressman who was, or a couple of congressmen, Marsha Blackburn as well, who put forth a bill to hobble us at the behest of not just the big pharma, but also these distribution services, these distributors of drugs. It just makes you wonder. I mean, the whole story of our war on drugs has been going after the drug kingpins, going after the source. That's always been the mantra. We sprayed herbicides on the jungles of South America to go after the source. So it just is extraordinary to think that in the terms of the OxyContin and the opioid epidemic here in the United States, the source has been completely known all along with an address, but nobody's wanted to go after him. So is that really a testament to the power of big money?
I believe it is. And I think that the Food and Drug Administration could have stopped Purdue Pharma. And what we saw was a failure of the regulatory agency and a failure of Congress to see that FDA was doing its job. And I believe all of it has a lot to do with the tremendous influence that pharmaceutical companies have in Washington.
And the Sacklers themselves, are they big lobbyists apart from their philanthropy? Whether or not their philanthropy is a form of atonement, I don't know. But it would seem to be, given the you know, the pain and suffering that this drug has caused and this epidemic that is ongoing here in the United States. I mean, some of those statistics about these small pharmacies in West Virginia with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pills, more than the populations of the surrounding areas, it's pretty extraordinary, pretty flagrant what's been going on, has it not?
It has. The Sacker family, I'm not aware of their lobbying on opioids. They've seem to keep a distance between their family and their product, but their company, Purdue Pharma, has had quite a presence on Capitol Hill and has been very effective at lobbying.
Well, just in closing, when is something going to happen? I mean, Trump himself said the other day when this whole scandal about the congressman nominated to be the head of the drug czar, when he withdrew, Trump said that we'll be getting next week, which is this week now, we're going to make a major announcement about how to deal with the opioid crisis. I've been hearing that for some time. They're always talking about we're going to come up with a way to take it on, but have you, so far?
It's a bit strange to call something an emergency and then not take urgent action, and that's basically where we've been. The rumor is that on Thursday, President Trump will announce an emergency designation of the opioid crisis. Hopefully we'll hear that, and we'll know if President Trump is serious about tackling the problem if the announcement includes a request from Congress to appropriate funding for the problem. And I believe we'll know that Trump is serious if the funding request is for a figure north of $1 billion, which is what I believe we need to really expand access to addiction treatment for the millions who have become addicted. We need to get to a place where someone who's addicted can access treatment more easily than they can access pills, heroin, or fentanyl if we want to see overdose deaths starting to come down. And so we'll find out Thursday whether or not President Trump means business.
And just in closing, you mentioned fentanyl. That's even more potent than everything we've been talking about so far, whether it's heroin or OxyContin.
That's correct. So older Americans are dying of overdoses from prescription opioids like OxyContin and from OxyContin. Younger Americans who wind up having to switch to heroin after they get addicted, deaths in that younger group in the past few years have started to increase very rapidly because the heroin supply is much more dangerous. Increasingly, it has fentanyl, a very potent synthetic opioid, mixed into it, and in some cases, it's fentanyl being sold as heroin, and so the deaths are just soaring in that younger group.
Well, Dr. Andrew Kolodny, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
For having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Andrew Kolodny, who is the co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. His primary area of focus is the prescription opioid and heroin crisis devastating families and communities across the country. He's also the executive director of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing, an organization with a mission to reduce morbidity and mortality caused by overprescribing of opioid analgesics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.